Subcommittee on Health Policy to order. And just want to let everyone know today what our order of activity here is. We're going to start off with House Bill 2800 with about 30 minutes of carried over testimony. We know he's going to be testifying. We have a list from the other day, plus a couple others. We're really going to try to do that very quickly. I'm going to limit folks to 2 minutes. So speak quickly. And if you have written testimony, please don't read it. Just summarize it. Then we're going to move on to some work sessions. We're going to start with House Bill 2650 and then do 2386, Senate Bill 200, and then House Bill 2524. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2800. Sandy, I think we have some materials that we should note for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the subcommittee, yes, behind your SMS and your agenda, you should have at the top a piece of testimony from Linnea Lindsay, two pieces of stapled, and then the PowerPoint that folks had requested from you. You also have some in-writing testimony from the ACP with an envelope. It is my understanding that you may have already received that testimony via email. So this is a duplicate of that email also. And with that, Madam Chair, you may proceed.
Thank you, Sandy. And before we call up our first couple testifiers, I just want to mention that I've had a chance to look through all the written testimony we had through. So if you haven't, it's really interesting. We have some primary care physicians. What struck me from all this is very strong arguments on both sides, and I hope we all have a chance to read everything that we got the other day. So with that, I'd like to call up Dr. Newman, Dr. Whitehead.
That's a telephone.
We'll do that in a second. Dr. Newman, and then Barbara Lamondry. Okay. And again, please try to keep it brief. I have my timer. So, Dr. Newman, start us off.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson, distinguished members of the committee. It's a privilege for me to be here today. My name is Dr. Stuart Newman. I am a physician, a board-certified psychiatrist, practicing in Beaverton. I am also a forensic psychiatry fellow at Oregon Health and Sciences University. I'm a member of the Oregon Psychiatric Association, the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and the Oregon Medical Association. All of these organizations strongly oppose House Bill 2800. I am here today to also urge you to reject this bill. The goal of my testimony, and I provided you with written copies of that, is to educate you, to make you informed consumers regarding this bill. I'm here today nearing the completion of my 14th year of education since I graduated from high school. I wanted to highlight the differences in medical training that is inherent in this bill. A medical student attends medical school for 4 years, assuming a 50-hour work week. That's 2,400 hours per year, 9,600 hours over the 4 years. A standard psychiatric residency is an additional 4 years, an additional 9,600 hours of training for a total of 19,200 hours of medical training specifically focused on what we do. Additionally, there are subspecialty training programs that are an additional year to 2 years, which also include additional training. House Bill 2800 does not specify if there is a distinction for psychologists in which subpopulations they can treat. The American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, who is the accreditation board for psychiatrists, specifically notes subpopulations and requires subspecialty training before providing added qualifications for individuals who seek board certification. This is all summarized in my handout.
Dr. Newman, about 30 more seconds.
Okay. For any physician in the United States, they must complete a three-part examination called the United States Medical Licensure Exam. From there, they then go on to also complete board certification, which is a two-part test. Anyone wishing to be trained in a subspecialty must also complete an additional examination. Oversight is considerable for medical doctors in this country. House Bill 2800 does not address these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being concise. I appreciate that. Ms. Lamondry?
Hello, I'm Dr. Barbara Lamandry. I'm a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. And
my apologies, doctor.
That's okay. I'm not offended. And I'm an associate professor at Linfield College School of Nursing. I have distributed a packet of material to you. The first two pages are my responses based on Tuesday's testimony, and then the remaining pages are my comments that I wanted to add to the record based on Tuesday, or that I was bringing on Tuesday. What I'd like to do, Chair Kotek and committee, is to point out some of the facts that underlie this this issue, and not speak on opinion. I'm neither for nor against the bill. I'm against some of the provisions in the bill, which I understand the co-sponsors are correcting, and I've pointed that out in my material. I want to tell you that I did suffer through reading the GAO report, which is a very important thing to do, and it's a good replacement for Ambien if you have any concerns. The GAO report did study quite extensively psychologists prescribing through the DOD's psychopharmacology project, and project went from 1991 to 97 and graduated 10 psychologists. They carried an equal caseload as psychiatrists, and they showed equal patient satisfaction. They performed at an excellent level, as did the psychiatrist. Their prescribing was compared and were equally safe. And I might point out that the major difference between psychologists and psychiatrists was that psychologists prescribed one-third fewer medications, but the outcomes were the same. They now serve as department heads and chiefs of service, both in the military, those that are still active, those that have left, two are in medical school, and the remaining are faculty in the seven schools that now are offering programs in this field of study. There were no adverse consequences from that experiment. In New Mexico, it's only been in existence since 2002, so data is not available. I did call New Mexico, the board, and there are 8 or 9 psychologists who have completed the requirements, 2 who have completed supervised hours. There have been no adverse consequences. I call the insurance board of New Mexico. There have been no claims. Now, those are very limited data because there are few psychologists practicing this, of course, and that's because there are only 2 states that offer this. However, we have a real interesting record right here in Oregon. Another non-physician prescriber group are psychiatric nurse practitioners. And Representative Greenleck, I promise you that the irony of my being here is not wasted on me. I do remember 25 years ago when Dr. Bloom testified that nurse practitioners were certainly not qualified to do this. I might point out in the 25 years since then, Oregon has been a model Nurse Practice Act for the rest of the country. 48 states now have prescribing nurse practitioners. And by the way, we have nearly 2,000 nurse practitioners in Oregon and 304 psychiatric nurse practitioners. My insurance quadrupled 2 years ago, my malpractice insurance, and I called the board to ask why, the insurance board. There have been no claims against psychiatric nurse practitioners. That doesn't explain why I'm paying 4 times more, but that's beside the point. I also want to point out that the educational preparation is not a crash course. It's 2 years of study, and the reason why the DOD stopped its project was because it was too expensive and didn't add to readiness of the combat forces. You don't prescribe medications, psychotropic meds, to soldiers. Now, I want to emphasize, the rest of this is in my note, but I want to emphasize the concern that I have for this bill, and that is the relationship to the primary care provider. This is a critical link and the most difficult one to monitor. I'll point out that Our clients don't lie to us, but they underrepresent themselves many times when we ask, do you have a primary care provider? Oftentimes they mean the emergency department, which is not a primary care provider, or they haven't seen their primary care provider at all, or their primary care provider has changed and they don't know it. This affects the continuity of care between the prescriber, the psychiatric prescriber, and the primary care. And this is where I think we have the most serious problem. I can assure you that as one who works very closely with primary care providers, they don't want to be prescribing these meds, and they want to know that someone is skilled at this. Now, the last point I want to make is, why do psychologists want to prescribe? It is not because rural Oregon needs this. If you look at the map, you'll see that there aren't psychologists in rural Oregon any more than there are psychiatrists or psych nurse practitioners. This isn't going to make a difference. I think they want to prescribe, clearly as a matter of having more autonomy and control over one's patient care, and this is a good enough reason, and I don't think it's one to apologize for. It's why I decided to prescribe, and it is a way that you can maintain the continuity of practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lamondri, and I appreciate the neutral and the addition of facts, because I do think there are facts on both sides of this argument. Sometimes, especially in the written testimony, there's a lot of emotion, so I appreciate the numbers. Any questions for the panel? Representative Greenwood?
A brief question. In the 2005 session, we granted prescribing privileges to clinical nurse specialists. I wonder if you can compare a clinical nurse specialist to 72 years of medicine that the psychiatrists get.
Well, it's actually an anomaly. It's an East Coast, West Coast anomaly. What on the West Coast we call psych nurse or nurse practitioners, the East Coast call clinical nurse specialists. And it's the problem with the Mississippi River, you know, things divide the country. Essentially, in the East Coast, the preparation for a nurse practitioner and the clinical nurse specialist are the same. The curricula are the same. That's required by the advanced practice organization that monitors that. So there's very little difference. It's just a difference in titling, and Oregon titles it differently.
Thank you. With that, we have a phone call for our next person. Thank you for testifying. Really appreciate it. Good to see you today. Next person, we have a phone call with Dr. Michelle Whitehead. And then the next folks coming up on deck, Dr. McCarthy and Dr. Dodson. Hi, Dr. Whitehead?
Yes.
Hi, this is Representative Tina Kotek. You're with the Health Subcommittee on Health Policy. How are you?
Good.
Good. Well, thanks for joining us today. We're ready to take your testimony on House Bill 2800. For the record, just identify yourself, and you have 2 minutes. Sorry, we're keeping people pretty short. I might give you a little more. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
It's pretty quick, sorry.
All right, I've written my testimony, so hopefully I'll speak quickly. My name is Michelle Whitehead, and thank you for allowing me to testify by telephone. I am a registered licensed psychologist in California, Oregon. I am a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner with an advanced prescription license card. I practiced in Los Angeles, San Luis Obispo, California, and Bend, Oregon. I've taught at the University of Psychology and Human Services for 9 years at Cal State Polytechnic University at San Luis Obispo. I have worked in psychiatric and acute care hospitals as a nurse and a psychologist. I was on the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners for 6 years, ending my second 3-year term in 2003. During my first year as president of the San Luis Obispo County Psychological Association, I participated in securing staff privileges for psychologists in 2 hospitals under California CAP, which is California Advancement of Professional Psychology, which was a grassroots initiative to provide psychologists admitting privileges. I reviewed the House Bill 2800, the Alliant University's MS program in clinical psychopharmacology, and I've reviewed the current curriculum of the nursing graduate program in psych mental health at UCLA, where I attended. I have had ongoing dialogue for years with my colleagues in psychology, nursing, and medicine. I am married to a family practice physician. Although I am licensed as a mental health nurse practitioner and work independently in that capacity when I prescribe, I routinely obtain supervision as needed from a psychiatrist colleague.
It was brought to my attention that there has been testimony that one, family physicians are ill-equipped or not adequately trained to prescribe psychotropic medicine, and two, FPs and psychiatrists are unavailable. It has been my professional experience that family physicians and psychiatrists are available to me for the asking. Yes, there is a shortage of psychiatrists in the county mental health program statewide. This is a funding issue not going to be cured by psychologist prescribers. Our mental health department here in Deschutes County does not even have a full-time licensed psychologist, and they rarely use the services of psychology. Individuals or the individual profess to this committee that FPs are inadequately trained, do not know their facts about FP programs and their residency training. I have the following concerns about the proposed bill, and some of my comments will be directed to Alliance Program, as the Oregon Psychological Association is using this as a model of training.
Dr. Whitehead,
yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you have about a minute, and if
I don't have much.
Okay, good. Okay, because you can also submit whatever you have in writing as well. So.
Oh, okay. The Alliance Program lectures are too spaced out. Meeting every 3 weeks is inadequate, in my opinion. A 70% pass rate on examinations is too low. Would you want to have your mood stabilizing medication such as lithium or Neurontin prescribed by a practitioner who is at a C level, whether that was an NP, MD, or PhD? A 70% pass rate in nursing or medicine would be a fail. You'd be required to redo the course. The assumption that psychologists have sufficient pre-doctoral science background is faulty. My experience teaching and giving oral examinations to psychologists in two states has shown me that the majority of psychologists have undergraduate degrees and non-science majors. It has been my experience as an examiner that current applicants for licensure as a psychologist have no hospital training. The program does not provide for laboratory exercise, the number of contact hours to teach pathophysiology, biochemistry, etc. is insufficient. The physical assessment and laboratory evaluation course does not direct patient contact. Minimally, you have to know how to do a vital sign before giving medication. You cannot learn this task via video conferencing. Now, there's some other issues that I have that I can go ahead and mail to the committee, which relates to the OPB's ability to oversee licensure and competency standards and my experience with that as being as a board member. But in conclusion, the time may have come to look at the advanced practice of psychopharmacology and the practice of psychology. The Department of Defense program, which ended in 1997, appeared to have an appropriate model which include in-class lectures and clinic work. This program of 3 years and subsequently reduced to 2 years may be a more appropriate model than the Alliant University model. I am a strong advocate of a university-based training program with a medical school. The student psychologist should be supervised by clinical staff and should, at a minimum, participate in a two-year program if they want to practice independently. The other option would be a program similar to physician assistants, whereby the PA works under, or the psychologist would work under the supervision of a prescribing MD. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Whitehead.
And could you please tell me where I can send my written comments to?
Yes, we'll have the committee staff people call you back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Dr. Whitehead? Seeing none, thank you so much for being online today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Have turned off. Okay. Next we have is it Dr. Weaver? And then John McCulley. I think that's the remainder of some of the folks from the other day. And the last few people I have up would be Dr. Steiner, Betsy Earls, and Dr. Henderson. I think that would be everyone. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, great.
No, I'm Weaver.
Weaver, please go right ahead.
Thank you, Chair Kodick and members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Weaver, MD, and I listened with interest to the testimony Tuesday, March 20th on House Bill 2800. As an internist with 30 years of clinical experience at Providence St. Vincent's, and as a regent for the American College of Physicians that represents 125,000 internists worldwide, I felt compelled to provide testimony about the role of primary care for patients with mental illness. As an internist, my practice provides access, diagnosis, and treatment for all medical problems. I take care of the full spectrum from the simple common ailments to cardiac, gastrointestinal, and all the different system diseases and psychiatric disorders. 40% of my daily practice involves patients with mental illness alone or in combination with physical illness. My patients typically have diseases involving multiple systems and take a number of medications that potentially could react with each other or with their diseases. The most common mental health diagnosis, and this is listed in my letter so I won't go through it, is depression, which has a differential diagnosis of literally hundreds of conditions, including many medical besides psychiatric reasons. The mind truly interacts with the body, and to try and separate these functions may lead to misdiagnosis, improper treatment, and poorer outcome. That is why I didn't train 17 years, but 8 years after college to become a primary care physician treating complex interactive problems in a longitudinal fashion. I commonly diagnose psychiatric disorders and prescribe first-line psychotropic medications with good results. If the psychiatric disorder requires complex pharmacological expertise, I consult a psychiatrist. If the problem involves deficiencies in social interaction, I collaborate with a psychologist. The direction of this collaborative relationship is important for you to understand. As with referrals from a primary care physician to other specialists, whether you're talking about a cardiologist or a neurologist or whatever, the integration of care remains with the generalist. Fragmentation of patient care and too many prescribers may lead to dangerous drug interactions and avoidable morbidity and mortality. There's no advantage to the patient for psychologists to prescribe. However, there is an important role for psychologists on the treatment team. Psychological collaboration with their primary care physician as the coordinator of care for the whole person is the key. And although there are problems in access to mental health service, HB 2800 is not the answer. I stand in opposition to this bill.
Thank you, Dr.
Did I make my time?
You got a little over, but I appreciate your letter, so thank you very much, and thank you for doing that quickly. Mr. McCulley.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John McCulley. I'm representing Oregon Psychiatric Association. In addition to my own testimony that is being handed out, I'm also bringing testimony from Alice Heron, a parent of a mentally disabled person from Washington County, and also Dr. Robert McKelvey from OHSU. I should tell the committee I come before you today not as a dispassionate lobbyist on this issue. My son deals with some and has dealt with some psychiatric issues and still is working through that, both in the mental health system and in the juvenile justice system. So as looking at his condition, I am very concerned about allowing less than properly trained people to deal with those who have mental disorders. I want to talk specifically, I guess following up on Dr. Whitehead's issues about the Department of Defense. Just to understand, I attached to my testimony a salmon-colored sheet that kind of summarizes the Department of Defense training program. To be very clear, as Dr. Whitehead described, it was one full year of didactic training and one full year of clinical training. That clinical training was performed under the direction of psychiatrists at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. So there was a very, very intense, is what I'm trying to say. Compare that with the Alliant program, the summary that I've attached to my testimony, the 432-hour program plus the 18-hour study for the national exam. I would call your attention to the second page of that on the back of the first one. Toward the bottom, flex plan, just to give you an idea of what is possible under this program. As you can see under the flex plan, you don't have to go to the Kingstad Meeting Center in Beaverton to do the televideo conferencing. It can be done via audio conferencing from your home. We believe that that is not adequate training to prescribe the medications we're talking about.
Mr. McCulley, may I ask a question?
Sure.
The asterisk that says the plan is not available for students who live in Louisiana, do you know why that is?
Madam Chair, I don't know. I could speculate that because they probably feel it's not adequate.
Okay.
I don't know the answer to that for sure.
Okay, and you have 1 minute.
1 minute to go. And just to note that the Department of Defense program cost $6.1 million for the 10 psychologists who completed that program. The math says $610,000 a person. Was very expensive and very intense program. The other parts of the bill that I think I would like to specifically comment on, page 2 of the bill, lines 14 to 16, talk about the 1 year of treating patients with mental disorders. There is nothing specific about that. Since the rest of the training program can be part-time, does this 1 year also mean part-time? Or is it a full year of intense training? That's very unclear in the bill. The bill also calls, as you can see on page 2, starting at line 26, the Board of Psychologist Examiners having sole disciplinary authority regarding prescribing psychologists. I am not aware that the Board of Psychologist Examiners has any medical expertise at all to determine, number one, what the list of pharmaceuticals should be on the list, or how to discipline psychologists who may go beyond the bounds of proper prescribing.
Mr. McCulley, I need you to wrap
up. So my conclusion is that there is a woeful lack of medical oversight throughout the bill, and I think it is seriously flawed for those issues.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any questions for either of the... Yes, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Dr. Weaver. Thank you for being here, Dr. Weaver. I noticed on it's the second page of your written testimony, and you also said that if the psychiatric disorder requires complex pharmacological expertise, I consult a psychiatrist. We heard a lot of testimony on Tuesday about the shortage of psychiatrists. For some reason or another, there aren't very many psychiatrists. The rate of medical students who are going into psychiatry is declining. Do you ever have trouble reaching a psychiatrist when you need one? And if not, do you attribute that to being in an urban area as opposed to a rural area?
No. In my 30 years of experience, I was able to reach psychiatrists and had a good working relationship with them. I tried not to overburden them with patients that I felt that I could take care of. So that I think if the primary care physicians take care of the ball. The thing is, the focus that I heard on the previous day's testimony was on the seriously persistent mentally ill person, like a schizophrenic. That's only 1% of the psychiatric problems. Many of these patients can be taken care of very adequately by the primary care physician, but if they can't, then just like if I have somebody that needs a cardiologist for an angioplasty or whatever, I could call them. But I did not have problems finding them. I don't know how that is in the rural area. I've never practiced there. I think it would be better. I think part of the reason that there haven't been as many psychiatrists has been addressed in the past by Oregon, and that was to have parity for mental health issues. But it's going to take a little while for that increase in parity for the pipeline to produce the psychiatrists that we need. Does that answer it?
Yes. Thanks. Any other questions? Thank you for being here. And as you can see, I'm being generous. I want to get through these last couple. Dr. Steiner, good to see you. And Dr. Henderson. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
Good.
Thank you for inviting me.
No problem. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you again for offering me the opportunity to testify on this important piece of legislation. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, a statewide specialty society of approximately 1,000 practicing physicians across Oregon, and we are in opposition to House Bill 2800. We do clearly support anything that increases access to all sorts of health care, including mental health, for all Oregonians. However, we do not believe that this proposed legislation would increase this access. And furthermore, it has several significant flaws which have the potential to cause harm to patients.
Dr. Steiner, just a second. Did you announce your name for the record?
I apologize. Elizabeth Steiner.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Duly noted, Representative Greenlight.
Thank you, Representative Greenlight. Family physicians are really on the front line of mental health in Oregon. As Dr. Weaver so eloquently stated, those of us in primary care practice see a substantial number of patients who have mental illness either solely or in combination with multiple other medical concerns. Approximately 70% of all psychotropic drugs, such as antidepressants, are prescribed by family physicians and other primary care physicians like Dr. Weaver and the other internists. Approximately 50% of our patients have a psychiatric diagnosis, either alone or in combination with other health issues. This level of involvement, this level of exposure, gives us significant expertise in caring for these patients and for understanding all the ramifications of prescribing psychotropic drugs. Our expertise is based not only on our ongoing work with our patients, but also on substantial education obtained throughout our training and continuing medical education while we're out in practice. This training includes detailed coursework in general pharmacology in medical school with a substantial component on the issues around drug-drug interactions for what happens when you prescribe multiple drugs to one patient and how they may interact for positive or negative effect. This education is reinforced by our classes in pathology, pathophysiology, and neurobiology. In addition, we have training in focused clerkships in family medicine, internal medicine, and psychiatry. And then, when we're out in our postgraduate training, we have at least 3 years of supervised clinical experience taking good care of these patients with their mental illness in combination with their other illnesses.
Dr. Steiner, one more minute.
Thank you. As new drugs become available, we read articles in journals, we attend classes. In fact, when the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians has its annual continuing medical education meeting, a bare minimum of 15% every single year is related to mental health issues and psychotropic drugs. That's how important we think it is. And we learn about these things, and we consult, as Dr. Weaver said. And no, I've never had any trouble getting a hold of psychiatrists. My colleagues in rural Oregon pick up the phone and call the OHSU consult line and have access to a psychiatrist 24 hours a day if need be, and that's never been an issue at all since OHSU set up that program several years ago. Finally, we have the benefit of ongoing work with our patients, seeing how they respond to these medications, monitoring appropriate laboratory testing and vital signs analysis that may be important for managing these medications, understanding how the side effects of medications affect patients because these medications do have significant side effects, and adjusting doses of psychotropic and other medications to appropriately account for their pharmacokinetic interactions. The role of psychologists in providing cognitive therapy for patients with mental health issues cannot be underestimated. However, to add a prescribing authority to this role has several serious potential adverse effects. The training outline in House Bill 2800 does not even begin to compare to the breadth and depth of training and supervised experience that family physicians have. Additionally, the more providers involved with prescribing medications for a given patient, the greater the chance of adverse effects. Family physicians have long enjoyed collaborative relationships with psychologists in the care of patients with mental health issues. We would ask psychologists continue with their excellent care on the cognitive therapy front while we continue to provide patients psychotropic medications in the context of their entire health. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Steiner. And last one, Dr. Henderson. And then we'll take questions if anybody has any.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak with you again. I will combine Ms. Earle's testimony with mine. She had a conference to go to, a parent-teacher conference of the small child kind. And I'll just state briefly, I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I've had 9 years of education after high school and 18 months of residency supervised after that. I am not a prescription-trained psychologist, but I'm here today to speak to just a few issues that have been raised, and I will keep it very brief.
Your name for the record.
My name for the record, Dr. Robin Henderson.
Thank you.
Thank you. I am from Deschutes County, and I will tell you, being from Deschutes County recently, I had a Blue Cross Blue Shield patient who needed a psychiatrist, and I have access. I run the behavioral health unit. Those six psychiatrists worked for me 4 months. I couldn't pull any favors. So even I sometimes can't pull a favor. We've heard a lot about access, so I just want to make two quick points. Telemedicine is great. I'm a big proponent, and you know that. But all it does is change the dispersal. The second issue are the studies that have recently come out, not only in the Governor's Mental Health Task Force report from 2004. I refer you to Appendix G, the Behavioral Health Workforce portion, that talks about the access problems in the Governor's Mental Health Task Force, and also the Community Services Work Group report that just came out 2 days ago on page 15. For many persons with serious mental illness, medications are essential to healthy living in the community. Both medication funding and access to licensed medical professionals who can assess and prescribe medications are a necessity. Those are two recent reports speaking directly to access. Training. We've heard a lot about training. I have further documents that we can provide you, but suffice it to say, we're talking about non-physician prescribers here. We're very clear, like the psychiatric nurse practitioners. We would love to work with a school in Oregon, like Linfield, like the U of O, like OHSU. That would be wonderful to have an actual program here. We have to establish all of these critical things together to get that at that point. But I won't detail the training program. I believe you have that in the handout. I do want to talk about the one-year postgraduate experience and give you two examples of how that would work. One example that one of our psychologists looked at is working with La Clinica La Familia up in Hood River, where she would be an embedded psychologist prescriber with the physicians at La Clinica La Familia, and they're very excited about that opportunity. Another one of the psychologist prescribers is working with a pain clinic in Washington County, and he would be embedded with the pain clinic doing his work there with physician oversight for that period of time and would likely stay for both instances. So we're really looking at psychologists embedding themselves in practice clinic settings like that to practice. Lastly, the examination, the national examination, that type of detail, I can also provide you with that, but there is a national standard examination that has been used for many years. The integration of clinical work and didactic instruction will continue and will be part of this. I have given you two documents to talk to the accreditation of Alliance program. I'll allow you to read those and won't detail that. I do briefly want to address the issue of the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners. Questions have been raised about their role. We cannot speak on their behalf. However, I will tell you what our intention is and what our discussions have been. The BPE constantly has issues that are raised for them that are outside the scope of the practice of the people on the board. At that time, they bring in a consultant, just like the BME does when they get somebody who's outside the scope of the people who are currently sitting on the board. In Louisiana, where they're actively practicing, they started with consultants, medical psychologist consultants. Now they have two or three positions on their board that are medical psychologists. That same routine would happen here in Oregon. So they would seek consultation to bring in the expertise should a complaint arise. I won't detail my points about safety because I think that Dr. Lamondri did an excellent job of detailing the safety issues. I will ask, show me where it's not safe. This has been done for years in the DOD, in Louisiana, and in New Mexico. Show me where it's not safe, and let's have that discussion.
Dr. Henderson, I'm going to ask you to wrap it up.
Perfect. The number one indicator of a positive outcome in the therapeutic relationship is that relationship between the provider and the patient. Psychologists are excellent at that. We really want to see the mental health parity lobby brought out fully. The 1.3 million Oregonians who suffer from mental illness have access and choice for care. I really appreciated Dr. Lamondri's comment that it's about autonomy and control over patient care. And that's what psychologists are seeking, and we want to be part of the solution. We would be happy to consider amendments as needed, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Henderson. And questions for Dr. Steiner or Dr. Henderson? Seeing none, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
That's not too bad. Working on the timer. So that's it for the testimony in the public hearing. I would like to see us have a further discussion about this issue. I think that there are compelling arguments on both sides, and so what I'd like to do is have a work group. Do I have any takers on the committee that would like to work on this particular issue? I'd like to see both sides sit down and talk about the education issues, the board issues, the various things that have been raised. Perhaps we can't reach any kind of agreement, but I think it deserves at least one more discussion offline. So, Representative Flores, would you like to join the work group? Great, thank you. You and I then?
Sure.
That'd be great. With that, we'll close the public hearing on 2800.
There was a lot of dog bite man discussion here today. It would be nice to pay particular attention to the one letter I think we had from an MD saying this would be fine, and I think no letters we had from a psychologist saying this is a terrible idea. Let me just turn it to...
Well, we will see. Well, we'll get back. Stay tuned. So let's open a work session on Senate Bill 200. moving out of the order I originally had said. So we're going to do Senate Bill 200, then 2386, 2524, and then 2650.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 200 had a public hearing on March 13th. You will recall this bill comes from the Senate side with 22 aye votes and 5 no votes off the Senate floor. It increases the maximum civil penalty that can be assessed by the Board of Pharmacy from $1,000 to $5,000 per violation. It also authorizes the board to assess costs of the disciplinary process, and it grants the board ongoing jurisdiction in cases where licenses have lapsed or been suspended or revoked. At our last hearing, we did receive a -1 amendment from Senator George's office. You recall that splits out the civil penalty to be $1,000 for an individual and up to $10,000 per violation for a drug outlet. You also may recall that Representative Bonamici had raised some issues about the language in that amendment, and
I did have a conversation with Legislative Council because my concerns were twofold. First, I was concerned about the use of the word individual and wanted to make sure that that was the proper terminology. And we talked about perhaps changing that to licensee, but then it was pointed out to me by Legislative Council that if that's changed to licensee, then there's no ability to cite people who are operating without a license. And so that was the reason why they used the term individual. And then I also wanted to make sure that there was a definition of drug outlet, which is in line 4 of the -1 amendments. And we were planning on incorporating the definition of drug outlet that's in the chapter, but was informed by Legislative Council that because of form and style, not to repeat definitions that are in the same chapter, that was contrary to Legislative Council form and style, because the definition of drug outlet is, in fact, in the same chapter that this bill amends. So my concerns were addressed, and I'm not requesting further amendments to the -1.
Thank you, Representative Bonamici, for following up on all those issues. The other issue that was raised was some testimony from administrative law section of the Oregon State Bar having some issues about the penalty section. I'd have to go look back, but there were some concerns about how we were handling some of the aspects of hearings and things like that. And while there might be some worthwhile parts of those arguments, after further thought, it makes more sense for the administrative law folks to look at all of the sections and all the different boards that they have discomfort with and to come back and discuss those as a whole versus trying to address a particular issue with this bill. So there is no amendment to deal with the issues raised by the administrative law judge. So the only amendment we have on the table is the -1s.
Madam Chair, just to clarify for the record, it was the administrative law section.
Law section, thank you. So I'll entertain a motion for the -1s.
Madam Chair, I'd move the -1s amendment to Senate Bill 200.
Thank you, Representative Bruton. The motion is to amend Senate Bill 200 with the -1 amendments. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? Seeing none, so moved. We now have 200-1.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 200 to the full Health Care Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. 200 as amended with the -1?
Correct.
Thank you very much. So there's a motion to move Senate Bill 200 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Erin, would you call the roll?
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
Excused.
Vice Chair Bonamici.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bruin.
Aye.
Aye. With that, we'll move that on to the floor. Are we going to hear that tomorrow?
Yes, please.
Good question. Who would like to hear that? Representative Bonamici?
I will indeed.
Great. Thank you so much. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 200 and open a work session on House Bill 2386. What do we got, Sandy?
Madam Chair, we have House Bill 2386. We had a public hearing on January 25th on this bill. You may recall this allows, the original bill allowed the licensed physical therapist who has received the Doctor of Physical Therapy degree to specify that professional designation of doctor. It also prohibits a person or a business entity from representing that they are a provider of physical therapy services unless the services are provided by a licensed physical therapist. And extended specific circumstances for a physical therapist to refer a patient to another healthcare practitioner, and it had established timelines. What you have before you are dash three amendments and the dash four amendments. I believe there was a lot of work done on this bill behind the scenes, and the folks here who worked on those amendments are here to help explain them if the committee so chooses. But you should have a hand and gross version of 2386 that I believe should be delivered to your offices.
The dash fours?
With both the threes and the fours.
Okay. I had to do my own for the threes, for the fours.
Tracy's giving me something.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Would you like to introduce yourself for the record?
Sure. Good afternoon, Chair Kotek and members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Tracy Retton, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. And first, would like to thank you for considering House Bill 2386 today and the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments. I'd be happy to answer questions. I know that I've had the opportunity to speak with, I believe, all of you about these amendments. The amendments basically will specify that a person who is using the title doctor has a doctor of physical therapy degree. There are people who have a master's degree. The program for the DPT began, I believe, in 2000. It's not our intention that people with a master's would be using that designation. So this should specify that it's only for those people who have a doctor of physical therapy degree. The amendments also, if you look at the dash fours in combination with the dash threes, we are removing all of the language that deals with the protection of the term physical therapy. And that is, again, with the dash fours and dash threes combined. Representative Cromwell did bring to our attention some concerns with language as we had amended it in the dash fours, and I believe that's in the dash fours lines six through ten, I believe. And the language as it is worded there is not going to get us what we were hoping. So we are okay to delete that language in the dash threes do that. The last issue is the direct access issue that we had talked about in our public hearing. It was originally unlimited direct access. This would restore the language that we had previously in our statute and then would extend it by 15 days for a total of 45 days that we would have direct access to patients.
Thank you. Questions, please? Tracy?
Yes, I have a brief question. And thank you very much for your hard work on this one. The dash three is deleting the changes in section three, restore section three. Is that right to the way the law was?
From what I understand, yes. Combined, we have got all of that in section three of the bill is gone.
Just.
And Sandy can help with this. We had a long conversation.
Changes are gone. Right?
The entire section 3 is gone.
We deleted 6820.
Yes.
That what
yes.
So that's that whole section that
whole
was
section
in the law
is, correct.
Is no longer in the law.
And even though the dash 4s, Mr. Madam Chair, Representative Greenlee, we will have to, if both of these amendments are adopted, we will have to conceptually agree on the dash 4s to delete lines 6 through 10, since that was modifying the language that the threes are deleting.
Yes.
So we don't want to counteract the threes and the fours. So technically, the entire section 3 all the way, yes, the entire section 3 is being removed if you should adopt both amendments.
And Chair Kotek and Representative Greenlee, it is not our intention to remove language that exists currently in our statute. We just don't want to be dealing with changing any of our statute at this time that deals with our designations or.
I do want to make sure what we're doing, and I think there's a little confusion in what we just said.
Okay.
What we're not doing is amending 688-20.
That is right.
So 688-20 will remain as it .020 will remain in the statutes as they are current.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Section 3, Madam Chair, also has on page 3 of the Hendon Growth Bill language in 688.030, so that will have to be addressed. I think as you were talking about Representative Greenlit's question, that was talking about 020, which is addressed on page 2 of the bill,
right.
Hendon Growth. Page 3 of the bill has also section 3 regarding .030.
Correct.
So that language will remain as well, unchanged,
correct,
as in current statute.
Correct.
Which means, on line 1, we have deleted both 020 and 030, 030-2.
Yes, that's correct.
Yep. Okay. So they say exactly as they were.
So substantially what we're doing here is clarifying that a doctor, someone with a doctoral degree in physical therapy, you say they're a doctor, essentially,
right,
and expanding the direct access to 45 days from 30 days.
Chair Kotek, that is correct.
And just for the record, I had an email from Phil Donovan, Government Affairs for the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. With the adoption of the dash fours, they would drop any opposition to the bill. Any other questions?
I was informally told that by OMA as well.
OMA as well, Oregon Medical Association. Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions for the representatives from the association? Okay, great. So what do we need to do for the amendments, Sandy?
Take the dash threes as is.
Okay.
And then if the committee so chooses, if you're looking at the dash fours, you will just need to, in the amendment, say you want to conceptually delete on the dash four amendments lines 6 through 10. And then when I put a request into legislative council to combine these two amendments, we will not include that language.
Thank you. Representative?
Madam Chair, I would move the dash three amendment to House Bill 2386.
Thank you. There's a motion to amend House Bill 2386 with the dash three amendments. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Bruce?
Madam Chair, I would move the dash four amendment to House Bill 2386 with the conceptual deletions of lines 6 through 10 on the dash four amendment.
Thank you, Representative. The motion is amend House Bill 2386 with the dash four amendments with a conceptual amendment to delete lines 6 through 10. Any discussion? Representative Greenlee?
Yeah, I'm a little nervous about that long conceptual amendments. I mean, we have final amendments tomorrow.
They will do their best. When I talked to council this morning about this, the whole dynamic of these two amendments,
okay,
they will do their best.
So we'll either, if we have the actual version tomorrow,
yes,
we'll move the bill tomorrow. If not, we'll wait till Wednesday.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Greenlee. You addressed my concern as trying to put all these pieces together, and I'd prefer to see it before we vote it out.
Right. Duly noted. We'll see it one more time in the full before we move it. So any objections to moving it to the full as amended?
We didn't have yet.
I'll do that.
No, well, no, just on the dash fours. Any objections?
Yeah.
Seeing none, so moved. Representative?
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2386 as amended to the full health care committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. The motion on table is to pass House Bill 2386 with a due pass recommendation as amended to the full committee. Discussion? Erin, would you call the roll?
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Yeltsin.
Excuse?
Vice Chair Bonamici.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bruin.
Aye.
Chair Kotek.
Aye. We'll see that in the poll. Thank you so much. We'll close the work session on...
Need a carrier.
Representative Broom will be the carrier to the poll, and so that closes the work session on House Bill 2386. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2524. Representative Greenlee, could you give us an update on this?
Thank you. We thought we had amendments to it that we could act on, but even if we could have them, the amendments were simply too complex for us to try and manage in this session. So what, and 10 minutes ago we found out that it was an even more complex problem than we thought because there was another modest glitch in the amendments. So what I would ask you to do, Madam Chair, is I would ask you to accept a motion to move 2524 to the full committee without recommendation. And I think we'll have to hold it over till Wednesday. Make sure everybody has a chance to look at the amendment. So we probably won't try and do it tomorrow if you can do that now.
So to remind everyone, we have a full schedule for next Wednesday. So Representative Greenlick has moved to pass House Bill 2524 with no recommendation onto the full committee. Discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bonamici?
Just a logistical question on that. Do we move it without doing anything with the amendments, or do we have to incorporate amendments?
You
just move it as is.
And I think you'll like the amendments. I think we have complete agreement on it. There was this question and that question, and it's a very complex set. My L.A. Tom Powers has been working with the association and with the LCs, and I want to make sure you have a chance to look at the amendments before we have to act on it, because it's big and complicated.
Appreciate it.
Madam Chair, I'm a little concerned about doing that. We've expressed the same concerns on a couple of other bills that are less complex and perhaps less controversial than this one is. This one, to me, without suggesting which path we're going down, I think needs the full vetting and the full treatment of this committee before we move it on. I appreciate the fact that Representative Greenlick is suggesting that these are good amendments. I'm sure they are, but he's also suggesting they're very complex amendments, and that even sort of reinforces my thought that we ought to look at them here and not move it on first.
And I have basically no problem with that. It's just a scheduling problem. That schedule for this subcommittee is pretty full for the next 2 weeks. Is that not right? When do you think we'd be able to get it in on this subcommittee, Sandy?
That's good.
Not next Tuesday, right?
We're
full Tuesday.
Right,
Thursday. Is that all that's on? Is the AFT?
Well, we
can
try
Tuesday?
For next Tuesday, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't think Thursday's going to take all.
Yeah,
and then Thursday.
I think we've got some room next week.
Okay, no, that's fine.
Okay.
Will you make sure, if I may, ask Tom that the LC knows we need it by Tuesday? And the problem is that we need it by Tuesday
morning.
It would really be good if we had the amendments to the committee by Monday morning. Mid-morning Monday, if we can.
Yeah.
I think she's got it all but one issue, right?
Yeah, I can walk it through right now.
Well, just make sure we have the right thing ready for...
Representative Greenlick, do you want to remove your motion?
Yes, I'll remove my motion.
Okay, thank you so much. And so, are we, just to clarify, do we have a dash four in front of us? Are we looking at another set?
Yes.
We have... Can we ask him to come to the... There's one glitch in the dash fours, right?
Who are we looking at? Tom?
Tom?
Tom, would you come up, please, and introduce yourself for the record? Thank you.
We're going to answer them.
Which of those dashboard? No,
there's only Chair Kotek and members of the subcommittee. My name is Tom Powers, and I work for one of the members of the subcommittee, Mr. Representative Greenlick, and these are the dash four amendments. If you could just, do you want me to provide a summary of the glitch or of the entire
Yeah, no, just the glitch.
Here? Okay.
If we could hand correct
All right.
that.
The glitch is in section 7 and 8.
Sorry?
Section 7 and 8.
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlick, they are in section 7. And Section 8 of the Dash 4 amendments. Section 7 is the clause that amends ORS 442.445 to allow the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research to enforce the Act. Since the bill sunsets in Section 12, the amendment needs to revert back to the original statute. So they have what is called a double amendment here in Section 8. However, it says, or Section 3 of this 2007 Act, and it's bold instead of bracketed and italicized.
So it should be bracketed and
yes.
It should be bolded?
Representative Greenlick, you have a very smart LA.
I do. We'll get you a clean version. Basically,
it sounds like it's
a very small change.
It's a very small thing.
Chair
What's
Coach.
The other
so,
one? Is that the same one, both pages?
I think that there is one other small, Chair Kotick, there's one other small glitch about the definition of one of the hospital administrators who has certification on in infection control. It says they need to be a member of the Association for Professionals in Infection Control, and I think the president of the Capital Club, Bruce Bishop, could speak a little bit better to that than I could.
Basically, like a broader representative from the hospital community. But
yes,
I think if you've had a chance to look at these, they'll give you the sense of what the amendments are.
Well, I appreciate all the work your office has put into this. You know what would be helpful? Could we have a, I don't know, brief bulleted summary of what we've got here, because that would be really helpful.
Awesome.
Well, and Madam Chair, I have a question. We have been presented prior to this time, dash one from the Oregon Healthcare Association from Lauren Rhodes, dash two's ditto, and dash three from the Oregon Association of Hospital and Health Systems from Gwen Dathan. So are any of those considerations being made as we contemplate?
Representative, I believe the fours would replace the threes.
Fours replace the threes, and the others we can decide on.
And if you could just reference Mr. Powers in the memo, the ones and twos, and how they relate to the fours.
Nursing homes want to be left out. That's
right.
The summary of ones and twos.
That's one and two.
Which
one
is a
two.
Policy decision.
And you have not addressed that apparently in the fours.
No.
Doesn't that sound like it? Thank you for the clarifying question, Representative Flores. So we look forward to the summary. Thank you.
All right, and I apologize, Chair Kotek, to the other two members of the South Side of the Dais who had to listen to two Tom Powers testify in one day. I understand there was a Tom Powers in the Judiciary Committee.
Oh, well, you're
earlier.
Way better.
That's right.
Way
but,
well,
thank
you for the
clarification.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. That's up to you, Representative.
I know.
We will schedule this for Tuesday. Next Tuesday. So everyone, go home, read, and we'll be back.
This may be a double minute.
Well, this is the work session on Bill 2524. And we're going to take a 10-minute recess, and we'll be back on House Bill 2650. Open a work session on House Bill 2650. So, friends, we are. With 2650, we passed the dash twos and the dash sixes. This last week, on the 20th. And what we have today are the dash tens and the dash elevens. I'm also going to propose a brief conceptual amendment to the dash sixes. But what I'd like to start off first with is invite Mary Lou Henrich up for a moment.
Don't you even hear enough from her?
Oh, no. State your name for the record, please.
My name is Mary Lou Henrich.
With
Community Health Partnership and the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance.
Thank you for being back today. It's good to see you. So I just wanted to clarify something for the record. In some conversations we have had, Community Health Partnership and the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance has stepped up and said we will provide technical assistance. Could you elaborate on that for the record? So
yes.
Because we're going to go forward, and we'd love to know what you'd be able to do.
For the record, one of the issues that has come up is that kind of concern from the food service directors that some of this is complicated to figure out on those a la carte items that you mix together, and whether they've got the 450 calories or the 4 grams of fat per 100 calories. So we have said that if there are small districts or districts that don't have somebody that can figure that out for them, and we will be glad to assist in that. They can either get us the recipes, because they do have to keep within financial bounds, so it isn't like every day they're cooking up something new. They really do have menus and really do figure out what they're going to be serving, and then maybe an occasional new time when a new item is introduced. And so we can run those numbers for them. We can help them. We will get, and if we don't have the expertise, Community Health Partnership will hire the expertise that's necessary to do it.
Thank you, Mary Lou. And do you think you might be pursuing any funding, maybe with the Northwest Health Foundation, to help us move this along?
We have a grant request in for helping coalitions, and one of them is the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance and the this whole area around the junk foods in schools. So I don't know whether we'll get it or not, but even if we don't, I have talked this over with Nancy Becker, our dietitian expert from Portland State, and she assures me that there are computer programs. This is, you know, that we can get a dietetic intern probably, but whatever it is, if we have to have a PhD, somebody will have it.
Great. Well, we appreciate them stepping up to offer that assistance. Okay. If it's
convenient. Yeah, we want to help. That's the whole point, is that instead of arguing over this, I actually talked to Janet Beer yesterday on the phone from the School Nutrition Association, and I said, Janet, what we really want to do is get through this and then work together, and with the putting it off for until 2009, if you pass that amendment, that really gives us a lot of time to work together. And I said, I know that the School Nutrition Association wants to do the right thing for kids. And we want to do the right thing, and we will work it out together.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Any questions for Mary Lou? Thank you for being here today and clarifying that for the record. So let's start off with the Dash 10. Does everybody have a copy? So as you recall, this is based on the adding a beverage to the high school list of permitted beverages. This is in line with the it's a beverage that is not more than 12 ounces and contains no more than 66 calories per 8 ounces, and it is in line with the soon-to-be-released guidelines that have been changed from the Alliance for a Healthier Generation. So that's why this has been added at the request of the Oregon Soft Drink Association.
Madam Chair, I would move the Dash 10 amendments to House Bill 2650.
Thank you, Representative. Dash 10 amendments have been moved to House Bill 2650. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. The Dash 11s, let's move on to those. These are revision of the timeline discussion, some other things we talked about the other day. Representative Gelser, would you like to walk us through these?
So this, again, this is pointing towards providing more time for districts to comply with the things that are mixed on site or within the district. And so what this amendment essentially would do would say, first of all, in the original bill, the act was effective for implementation on July 1st of this year. This pushes all of that off for a year, which gives school districts time to look at their contracts and their policies and comply. And then it puts off for another year until 2009, implementing that for things that are prepared within the school district, that are homemade, school-made by the school district personnel until 2009. And what's been added since we talked about this the other day, there was some clarification, and basically the act takes effect in July of this year, for the purposes of saying that if a district enters into a contract with a vendor that would be in effect after 2008 during this first year, that they need to be sure that they can comply with those standards after 2008 for prepackaged foods.
Cindy, do you want to come up in case we have questions on this? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gelser, the section, well, between lines 4 and 7 that deals with the things that are prepared on site and sold individually, the things that are made by the schools, applies to high schools.
Yes.
Was there some sense that elementary and middle schools don't make their own food? I'm just wondering why that section is limited to high schools.
Manager and Representative Bonamici, this was in response to the idea that the issue seems to be primarily what's sold on that a la carte line at the high schools. There aren't a lot of a la carte lines at the elementary and middle schools. We really are talking about what those high school students are purchasing. And it's the entree and snack items. It's not anything else that might be cooked, like the federally reimbursed meal. So this is really about the big plates of French fries and those other kinds of things.
And Cindy from Legislative Council, just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Cindy Hunt, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel.
Thank you for coming back. Did we get all of that? It sounded good to me. I saw you nodding. We have all the time.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, good. And thank you for being here. Any other questions or comments about the Dash 11?
Could I just... Yes, the other purpose for putting off till 2009, in the testimony that we heard, there wasn't a lot of pushback around the vended foods, the prepackaged foods, because you can buy those, and then it was much more complicated
to do the mixing. We heard about the concerns that, you know, some school districts don't have dietitians or nutritionists that are there, and this really gives time for those school districts that are ready to go. And, you know, we heard Salem Kaiser did this in 3 months, and that's great. Not all school districts are going to be able to jump that quickly. And this is to allow that time for people to get the technical assistance that they need and hopefully to kind of be shaping a plan rather than jumping just to do it. So it's intended to be a response to those concerns and to provide more time for the local districts to respond.
Thank you. And I think, you know, with the one-year ramp-up to starting the rest of it in 08-09, I think that's a significant amount of time for schools. Like you said, some schools did it rather quickly, and some schools have higher standards than even what's in the bill, but giving that extra year and then 2 years for the a la carte in high school seems like a reasonable time for preparation. Representative Ford.
Thank you. And as we're talking about all of the, are we taking comments in regard to other elements of the bill as well?
Just on the dash 11.
Just on the dash 11. Well, I will withhold comment until the appropriate time. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative?
Madam Chair, I would move the dash 11 amendment to House Bill 2650.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bruhn has moved the dash 11 amendments to House Bill 2650. Any discussion? Any objections?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative
Bonner. I just wanted to comment that in follow-up to my question that I asked Representative Gelser, if it does happen that there are elementary or middle schools that are preparing their own food, is there a way to address that issue? Or will they have to start complying with the they're not included in the Dash 11 extension, year extension, correct?
Elementary and middle school. Representative Bonamici, that is correct. And and with lack of information to know how substantial that issue is in the elementary and middle school level, this seems, like Representative Gelser said, the bulk of the problems in high school. You know, there's always be an opportunity on the Senate side to discuss that, I would think. But from our understanding, it really is the high school level. But, you know, we could, there's always future review, but this seems to be addressing the issue that was raised the most, or at least the only one. I don't know if we, do we have any testimony from the elementary middle school level on the a la carte issue?
We did not. And again, I would, I think that there is the opportunity to discuss that at the Senate side. I think as I was working on this, I thought about the testimony that we had heard and perhaps was colored by my own experience of what I know to be true in my district, and I know that I think that's one of the challenges that we face, and a good thing about moving this over to the Senate is it gives a chance for the districts to raise things that we might not have thought about, because every district is somewhat different. So just as some districts have set higher standards because that's what their communities have demanded, some school districts won't be able to move as fast either because of their community desire or because of their financial and personnel resource needs.
I just wanted to raise the issue if it's a concern, because I have heard that expressed as a concern, that hopefully if that is a problem, it can be addressed.
Thank you. Thank you for raising that. So the motion on the table is to move the Dash 11 amendments. Further discussion? Representative Gelser.
Could I raise one more thing? We talked about this earlier today, and it might be a question that's explored on the Senate side, but the intention in this entering into a contract, some school districts that are, for example, in my legislative district, I have two school districts. One school district contracts with the other school district to provide their food, and the intent isn't that then that smaller school district would have to make that other school district comply with that high school a la carte in 2008 because they're contracting with them. So and maybe that's something that if it needs to be tightened up can on the Senate side,
right,
as well.
And Representative, I think that's a pretty specific example, so it might be something to raise on the Senate side, to be honest. I mean, we only talked about it today, and I really don't know. I mean, the intention would not be to somehow disadvantage that student, that
right,
school, if the
exactly
other school is meeting
exactly
the other requirements. So
exactly.
Representative Greenland?
Yeah, I think we have an issue. We're going to try to test this tomorrow, right?
Uh-huh.
We've got to find out whether we need a conceptual amendment. I think if there is a sense that there are a lot of middle schools that have a la carte lines, and I would agree with Representative Gelser, I don't think that's a real problem, then we ought to make it 7, 8, 9, or whatever on this. We can do that tomorrow. I mean, it would be good to be thinking about. But I think you're going to rather not take it to the Senate, I mean, to the House floor, and then say, okay, we'll clean that up on the Senate side. I mean, if this is anything more than a hypothetical problem, it'd be easy to conceptually add three numbers to that and make it 5, 6, 7, or 6, 7, and 8, along with 9, 9, 10, 11,
Representative Bonamici?
I was just going to say, from a policy standpoint, it doesn't make any... It's the same issue. It's the food that's being made by the school, and I don't think it matters whether it's elementary school, middle school, or high school that's making it. If we need to give them more time to get that set.
No, it isn't all food made in the school. It's only the other part.
I understand. Right.
It'd be easy to add three more grades to that if I can get it cleaned up. We can do that conceptually now. We can do that conceptually later.
Mary Lou Henrich again for the record. I do believe that middle schools, and there even are some elementary schools where they are making a la carte foods. And I personally think that if we're going to give, if you want to, you know, give this extra year, it would be best to simply maybe stop your sentence after the 2009-10 school year, period.
Right.
And then not specify any grade level, because that would indeed make it consistent. And the food service director is over the whole district, and so they're going to run into the same problem. And I personally think, since we're going to let them have the time, you should just make it for all schools.
Thank you, Mary Lou.
Yeah.
Yes,
I was going to just suggest that we take the Dash 11 back off the table for now and address that issue.
Thank you very much, Representative. We have Dash 12 amendments that actually do exactly what we've been discussing.
Oh. Imagine that.
So let's pass it up.
Thank you. I think that's what it does, like a period or whatever. That is quick. LC, wow.
Yeah, as I was sitting here. Yeah. Representative?
Madam Chair, I would move the Dash 12 amendments to House Bill 2650.
Representative Bruhn has moved the Dash 12 amendments to House Bill 2650, and Ms. Hunt can probably nod and clarify that. That basically takes off the grade level, is that correct?
Yes, Chair Kotek, the only difference between the Dash 12 and the Dash 11 is that, yes, the grade level requirement that was in lines 6 and 7 of the Dash 11s has been deleted, and then you have before you the Dash 12s.
Thank you very much. So what we have on the table now is a motion to amend 2650 with the Dash 12s. We'd like to be prepared in this committee.
Madam Chair, if Question? Only everything could run so smoothly.
We learned. I tell you, third time's a charm. It's all about timing. Other discussion on the Dash 12s? Any objections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? All right, we have the Dash 12s. So we have added the Dash 10s and the Dash 12s.
But you, did we?
We're moving
on. 11 withdrew.
He withdrew the 11. So we have Dash 10 and 12. And now I'd like to take us back. Just think back to last week, the Dash 6 amendments. So there's been some concerns raised about the language around the role of the Department of Education in monitoring these new guidelines for the schools. And the intent of the bill was never to set up a new level of food police in the Department of Education. It really was not supposed to put a lot of extra workload on the Department of Education. So I would move a conceptual amendment to the Dash 6s. And the reason we can make... Sandy, would you clear us in on the conceptual and the Dash 6s? Why we can do this?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the reason that I propose to the chair is at this point it is still in our committee. We can make those changes because once we leave the committee, all of these amendments will be combined into one. So making a minimal change to any of the amendments that are before the committee, it might be an appropriate time as opposed to waiting until another time and then having to reconsider the bill for... Et cetera,
so what I would move, and I would move that we amend, make a conceptual amendment to the Dash 6 amendments.
Have the Dash 6 already been amended?
We passed those last week.
On Tuesday.
We added the Dash 6s last week.
I think this is a conceptual amendment to the bill as amended by the Dash 6.
Okay, I would move a conceptual amendment to the bill as amended to change the word shall. In line 14 of the Dash 6 amendments to May.
Page 4,
line 14, change the word shall to may to read, the department may monitor whether school districts are in compliance with the standards required by this section. Goal here being, you know, obviously their capacity to do that, but may is easier than shall in this regard. So, discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so moved. So, thank you very much, everyone, for that small change. So, that change, that one word change, the dash 10s and dash 12s, that is what we have amended right now.
Is it time for tomorrow?
Representative? Yes, it is.
Yeah, you haven't passed it yet. Okay.
Yes.
I think there was some discussion on the order. Do you want to have a motion?
Motion.
Okay.
Madam Chair, with a lot of pride, I would move House Bill 2650 as amended to the full Health Care Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. The motion is to move House Bill 2650 as finally amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. And time for discussion on the entirely amended bill. Representative Flores.
And by my record, then, we have amendment dash 6s, dash 10s, dash 12.
Were there two six
dash 8s we held for further modification?
And I'll just, if I could, let me just summarize.
Okay.
So from the original bill, we have removed the mineral and vitamin content in the juices. That was the dash 2s. We have defined entree and snack and addressed the blended school issue in the dash 6s. In the dash 10s, we have dealt with adding an extra beverage to the high school allowed list. And the dash 12s are the implementation timelines and the small change to the May on the dash 6s.
Thank you. Thank you. That does clarify that it is in accord with my notes here, and I had some scratch outs as well. Now, all of this being good things to do, and I won't have the other discussion at this point, but the other good things to do. But what are we, if schools do not do these things that we are instructing them to do, are we penalizing them in some way? And I don't see that in the book.
Dynamite them in the summer.
Ms. Hunt, would you like to?
Other than having that hammer of law that we like so much.
Chair Kotek, Representative Flores, there's a statute, and I'm trying to remember the exact number. It's in Chapter 327. I think it's 103, but I could be a few numbers off, that talks about schools being standard schools, and there's a process in there that the superintendent of public instruction can use if any school district violates a law. A person can file a complaint, and they go through a process where they notify the school district, and I think they give them a year, and at the end of the year, if they're still not in compliance, then they start to withhold state school fund dollars. Most school districts don't get to the year because, obviously, the withholding of state school fund dollars is significant.
And just to address that, you know, no, there's nothing specific in this bill, but that sounds like that would be the official hammer. And I think the other issue here is particularly talking about the idea is that the school district board will make sure their school districts are doing it. That's kind of the local oversight that we're looking for in the bill. This isn't about the department tracking down everybody, but I think when Representative Gelser mentioned the other day as a school board former school board member, schools want to be in compliance with the law, so you know, I guess I'm not anticipating any problems, but it's a good question.
Thank you, and then I would thank you, Representative. I appreciate that. I would just probably put on the record my conversations that I've had with you in a prior setting, and that is I'm supportive of this bill. I'm disappointed we have to have this bill, that we have to put into law some common sense things, principles, ways of living our lives and raising our children. So that's one of those downsides for me, and I really did struggle to come to a point of casting my vote in support of the bill, because I find it difficult when we start legislating common sense, although I know Representative Greenwood would say that's a good thing.
Well, I really agree with you. I think it is crazy that we have to get to this, and the schools were asked to create plans that made sense, and they mostly didn't do it.
Well, and that was another follow-up on my comment. It was disappointing to me that so few of the schools did bother to come into compliance with the nutritional standards as set out. And looking at the obesity situation, it's, I think people, if you travel elsewhere in the country, and particularly California and Arizona, where it's warm and people are active, it's very clear that we have a very obese state. especially of our young children. I'm concerned about the diabetes thing as well, although we do hear that some of the precipitating factors to diabetes, we heard what yesterday in regard to some of the mental situations that are citizens face as well, and other contributing factors. So all of that having been said, I am supportive of the bill. I'm just disappointed that we have to go about bringing some of these common sense solutions by virtue of legislation.
Thank you for those comments. As a public health issue, that's sometimes the route we have to take, but I understand that perspective. Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I share some of Representative Flores's concerns. I was very skeptical. I mentioned when we first heard this bill that I actually read it with my teenage daughter, who sort of rolled her eyes and well, they'll just go across the street to the 7-Eleven and they'll just buy more than one. And I understand the needs here, that in fact, some of the things that persuaded me, in addition to all the changes that we've made, are talking with, for example, somebody I know who teaches in the area of healthcare and public health, who said it's very easy to calculate, for example, the food, caloric and fat with computer programs now. That's not a hard thing to do. Listening to the teachers talking about how it's difficult for them to be teaching health lessons and then having the students turn around and face a vending machine full of junk food. And part of me wants to say we need to have students who are able to make the choice, even if they're learning in their health class, because they're going to go across the street to the 7-Eleven and still be faced with unhealthy choices. But because these are our schools, I'm going to vote for this bill, but I hope we don't lose sight of the bigger picture of teaching students how to make healthy choices, and I hope this helps in that regard. My other comment that I made in one of the prior hearings, I just want to reiterate, is that our definition of healthy sometimes differs. I'd like to see students be able to get an apple or a bunch of grapes or a nectarine instead of a package of processed snack food. So that's, I guess, out there in the future somehow, some way.
Thank you, Representative. I might take that as a plug for extra resources for health education in schools. So, thank you.
Or reallocation of current resources.
Duly noted. Duly noted. Representative Byrne? Any comments?
I'll say it publicly because she won't say it for herself. Representative Kotek has been a monster when it comes to getting this done, and I mean a monster in a positive sense. Huge and making sure she's has been so diligent and so comprehensive and so amenable to pulling in the resources and taking the testimony and listening to the opposition, because there was some good opposition. The fact that we got to a -12 amendment demonstrates that there was some points that needed to be cleared up with this bill, and Representative and Madam Chair was just diligent in getting it done. And so I know you won't do that for yourself. I want to congratulate you, because even though it's both yours and mine name on the front of this and a lot of co-sponsors, Chair Kotek has done the lion's share of the work to make the process happen. So my hat's off to you.
Representative, and he sits right next to me on the floor, so I get to bug him all the time. He's an easy target. So Representative Greenlee.
I would say it's probably not the first time you've hung on the coattails of a smarter woman.
Be married up, Madam Chair.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Sorry. Just thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more comment that I forgot to mention. I also talked to my legislative district is almost all the Buren School District. It has a sliver of Portland School District, and they were here talking about how they're already above these standards. And Beaverton assured me that they will be as well. So. I just wanted to add that to the record, that I have talked to the districts and also reiterate Representative Bruin's compliments for your hard work.
Thank you very much.
I actually did have a comment. Well, we're going to do this tomorrow in the full committee?
Yes, we are. It's all.
Will we have a hand in version?
We will have some version of the amendments that will be explicable to people, yes.
Yes, and I will.
Absolutely. Thank you. Representative Gelson?
Sure. So I've appreciated the conversations that we've had about this. I was nervous about supporting it when we started out on the basis of local control and those other things. I also went and talked with my kids about this and was surprised to hear my small children talk about health and schools and the things that they ate. I also went back and reflected on my records as a... And I'd like to thank all the people that brought me a whole bunch of yogurt parfaits. I'm glad to know that they're the yogurt parfaits, and I've had some tasty snacks from Salem Kaiser School dropped off at my office. So I've learned a lot about food that can be made at school and how it can comply with new standards. But I also, in this process, went back and looked through my records of my years as a school board member. And in my district, in the district that I represent, that's one of the most common letters that I got as a school board member were concerns about what it was that we were serving in our cafeterias. And I think that that's why our school board responded, and I believe that probably our wellness policy was one of them that had the nutritional standards in it. They did set high standards that also addressed exercise and other ways to help kids in terms of combating obesity. And since the other district in my legislative district gets their food from that school district, they also benefit from that as well. So while I recognize that for some school districts this is, I want to acknowledge the challenge where communities aren't at that place and giving them the resources to do that, that there is going to need to be some give to make this happen. This is certainly in alignment with the values of my legislative district. And and I really want to thank you for the ability to push off the timeline, which will hopefully provide some assistance to those districts for whom this will be more of a challenge. Though I do want to acknowledge that for some districts this will be a challenge. But for the health of our kids, I'm willing to jump to yes on this.
Thank you. And I want to thank you all for all the hard work on this. This has been very labor-intensive, but I think we have a good product that we can, I think, get a lot of support on the floor. And since I'm from Portland, we have higher standards already, but I think the ultimate goal is making sure every child has access to healthy choices in their schools, and that's what we're going to achieve with this when it has full implementation. I want to thank Cindy Hunt and Elsie for all the numerous amendments. You've been wonderful. Thank you. I also want to thank the advocates, the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance, Community Health Partnership, Oregon Nurses Association, everyone who has worked on this bill, and the Oregon Soft Drink Association for their addition to this. And with that, let's call the roll.
Excuse me, I almost didn't come out.
Aye.
Representative
Gilson.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Barnes.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Barnes. Aye.
Aye. And I will carry it to the floor tomorrow. And with that, thank you all. And that closes the work session on 2650, and we are adjourned.